You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Philip Yun. I want to take you back to a fateful Sunday night in August 1971. A lot of Americans had just settled in to watch Bonanza, one of the most popular TV shows in the country at the time. And then President Richard Nixon interrupted the broadcast with an announcement his advisors thought just couldn't wait.
Good evening. Addressed the nation a number of times over the past 2 years.
The strength of a nation's currency is based on the strength of that nation's economy. I have directed Secretary Connally to suspend temporarily the convertibility of the dollar into gold or other reserve assets.
Nixon was taking the U.S. off the gold standard. Now, that might not sound like a big deal or nothing more than a quirk of history, but bear with me here. That's because Nixon's decision at the time completely upended the world's economic order. It was one of the several policy changes that became known as the Nixon shock. And this week, we're marking its 50th anniversary because it just might have lessons for us now in our post-COVID world. So we'll forgive you if you've forgotten what the gold standard was, or if it's been a while since you've brushed up on your 20th century macroeconomic policy. To be honest, we needed a refresher, too.
The golden ore is rich in store on the banks of the Sacramento shore.
This is how the gold standard worked. Essentially, you and me and the U.S. Treasury agree that gold is valuable. How valuable? Let's say $35 per ounce. So to earn your trust in that flimsy stack of three tens and a five, the U.S. Treasury has to keep 1 ounce of gold at Fort Knox. Because at any time, you can decide, I'd really rather have my ounce of gold than these lousy 35 paper bills. And the Treasury would say, well, ma'am, come and get it. The U.S. started pegging the U.S. dollar to gold like this in the 1870s, and it gave the global community a lot of confidence in the U.S. dollar. In fact, so much so that the dollar became the de facto international currency, which was instrumental in post-World War I and II rebuilding efforts. World leaders all made this official through something called the Bretton Woods Agreement in 1944.
At Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, delegates from 44 allied and associate countries arrived for the opening of the United Nations Monetary and Financial Conference.
But by the time Nixon took office in 1969, this financial system we built around the gold standard was at risk of falling apart. We were facing the threat of an international run on the bank. And this was just one of the several economic challenges the United States was grappling with at the time. NPR's chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley recently hosted a World Affairs event about this over Zoom. He sat down with Jeffrey Garten, who served as an undersecretary of commerce in the Clinton administration and who's written a book about Nixon's decision. Horsley takes it from here.
50 years ago this summer, America was at a crossroads.
Good evening. The Senate of the United States, for the first time, has taken steps to bring the Vietnam War to a close.
Earlier in the day, the Senate came within one vote of cutting off funds within 9 months.
Unemployment increased last month, and so did wholesale prices.
Inflation was on the rise. The U.S. was in the process of withdrawing from a long and costly war. And questions had begun to surface about the country's willingness and ability to keep shouldering its responsibilities as a global leader.
The pain of transition from war to peace, from inflation to stability, is real. And it is the business of government, of business, and of labor to help ease that pain as we move ahead.
All challenges that may sound familiar in our own time, half a century later. In that steamy summer of 1971, President Nixon summoned his advisors to Camp David for a fateful meeting. When the meeting was over, Nixon severed this country's last ties to the gold standard. He also began to rewrite the playbook that had governed international economic relations since World War II. Jeffrey Garten chronicles that meeting, the sea changes that followed, and the lessons for our own time in his new book, 3 Days at Camp David, How a Secret Meeting in 1971 Transformed the Global Economy. Garten is Dean Emeritus at the Yale School of Management and a veteran of the Nixon, Ford, Carter, and Clinton administrations. Jeffrey Garten, welcome to World Affairs.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
A book like yours takes years to research and write. I'm curious, did you know when you started this process what a rip from the headlines feel this would have in the summer of 2021?
Well, that's a great question. No, I didn't. I proceeded to examine an event with the intention of kind of illuminating an era. And it was only when I was maybe three quarters of the way along that it occurred to me that there were some real echoes of our own time. You know, I'm not a professional historian, but I know enough to understand that history never exactly repeats itself. But I must say I was taken with a lot of the parallels.
It does rhyme sometimes. Well, when Nixon called this meeting in August of 1971, the country was facing a variety of challenges. Inflation was on the rise. There was a trade deficit for what was then the first time in the 20th century. And perhaps most urgently, there was this threat of an international run on the bank. For decades, the U.S. had committed to other countries they could exchange their dollars for gold at a fixed rate. But by 1971, there wasn't nearly enough gold in U.S. vaults to keep that promise. In fact, there were four times as many dollars in international hands as there was gold for the U.S. In effect, Bretton Woods had written a check that Fort Knox could no longer cash. So what was the plan?
I love that expression that Bretton Woods had written the check, and you're absolutely right. You know, what you talked about was really quite poignant because in 1944, when the modern financial system was created, you know, right after, or actually even before the war was over, but with the anticipation that we could start from scratch, since so much of the world had really been decimated and international commerce, as we had known it, had just come to a stop. But at that moment, let's say the late 1940s, it's hard to imagine how preeminent the U.S. was as a power. I mean, we came out of the war even stronger than we went in, but no one else even matched that, you know, that kind of situation. And so we had, when the Bretton Woods Conference said, let's create a system in which the dollar is at the center, but the dollar will be exchangeable into gold, there was never any contemplation that the U.S. wouldn't have all the gold it needed forever. But over the next 20 years, a couple of things happened. One was that the system that was set up was phenomenally successful. And countries like West Germany and Japan came back, you know, they were revived almost in a miraculous way. So by the time that Nixon became president, the U.S. for the first time was facing really tough international competition. And as you said, everybody wanted the dollar. We were printing dollars. People were glad to hold it because they thought there was always the gold alternative. And it emerged that there were too many dollars for the amount of gold that we had. And the Nixon administration was living in fear that other governments might come in and ask for the gold. And if one did, all of them would rush through the door. And that, as you said, would have been a run on the bank and a disaster for the U.S. because not only would we have reneged on that commitment, but we were afraid that our allies would begin to think we would renege on our military commitments as well. Remember, this was really at the heart of the Cold War. So the Nixon administration was in an incredible bind. They realized there wasn't enough gold. And they also wanted to devalue the dollar because these other countries were becoming so competitive, it really appeared that the dollar was too strong. The dollar had been fixed really, you know, in 1944, 1945, when it could be so strong, it wouldn't matter, but not in 1971. So Nixon and his advisors went to Camp David with the notion they have to make a fundamental change in the way the global economy worked, but they were also very, very aware that this change, whatever it would be, could create a massive financial crisis around the world because this was the only system anybody knew.
Yeah, and rather than allow that run on the bank that would have exposed the promise as being hollow at that point, they decided to unwind the promise preemptively with very little warning to the other countries. It was sort of an economic shock and awe. What was the reaction overseas?
Well, let me just say that they were quite aware that making the decision and announcing it with no warning would shock the world. It would shock the economic system, you know, millions of traders and investors around the world, but it would also shock the political establishment abroad, especially our allies who expected consultation on the big issues. On the other hand, had they tried to negotiate this multilaterally, which some people in the administration were advocating, they were afraid that it would take so long, during which time the markets would collapse anyway. And so they had a very difficult decision to make, and they decided that they're going to shock everyone, and then they're immediately going to enter into negotiations to repair the damage and to create some new rules. And part of the story in my book, part of it is the meeting itself in which they made those decisions. But the other part of it really is, how did they execute those decisions? You know, how did they deal with the allies in such a way that the world economy didn't collapse, and that the actual political alliances not only remained strong, but even got stronger?
And this was coupled with some remarkable economic moves here at home, too. Not only did Nixon sever the last ties to the gold standard, but at the same time, he ordered new wage and price controls, an import tariff, a whole raft of domestic policies, many of which he had spoken out against previous to this. And again, there was a shock element to this. He actually preempted Bonanza to announce this to the nation on a Sunday night. How did people digest it here at home?
Well, you know, they made these decisions in, I think, as rational a way as they could. They brought to bear an enormous amount of analysis. Nixon gathered people of widely differing views and hammered out a coherent and consistent policy. And part of that was what you were talking about, was the domestic dimension. I think one of the things that really hit me about this weekend was that it was the coming together of international economic policy and domestic policy, which today we may take for granted, but in 1971, the US was not used to that. Everything was, you know, the international part was just a sideshow to our domestic economy. But what Nixon realized, and Nixon and the people around him, was you just can't devalue the dollar. If you try to devalue the dollar, it would be very inflationary, since all the imports would require more dollars and you know, it would be, the prices would go up. And so he implemented a wage and price freeze, which was very, very dramatic. It was basically putting a lid on the entire economy. And that also not only controlled the inflation that would come with a cheaper dollar, but we had inflation anyway. And he wanted to demonstrate to the world we were going to get our house in order, and he took a very drastic measure. And one of the things I discovered about Nixon was he didn't do things halfway. He liked the grand gesture. He liked the home run. And he had just announced that we were opening China, and he wanted something equivalent on the domestic side. And so he put a whole bunch of things together: tax incentives for certain industries to get the economy going, a wage and price freeze to hold down prices. And he imposed an import tariff so that it was kind of a threat to the allies that you better negotiate with us on exchange rates, and when we're happy, we'll take away the import tariff. So it was a very complex package, but with the exception of wage and price controls over time, I think was the best that could be done.
Well, let's talk about that supporting cast of characters who you paint a very colorful picture of in this story. A lot of these are people who would become much more famous later on, who were in the early stages of their career, for example. George Shultz at the time, White House budget director. Paul Volcker, a deputy at the Treasury Department. One of the most colorful, though, was already famous, John Connally, the Treasury Secretary, who had been the governor of Texas. You describe Connally as a man with no ideology, a practical Paul who was interested in what worked. He was a Democrat, but the Democrats thought he was a closet Republican. The Republicans thought he was a Trojan horse. He had helped Hubert Humphrey carry Texas in 1968. I confess, I did a double take when I saw that, and I double-checked your research there. He was a conservative who believed in active government, not unlike Nixon himself. And even though he had no background in international finance, he was a quick study. I think you quote one of his tutors as saying, after a couple of lessons, he knew everything I did but could explain it better than I could. Talk about John Connally's role and the way he came to this Camp David summit.
Well, I think you've described him very well. Let me just add one dimension, that he was a strident nationalist. He had a motto, let's screw the foreigners before they screw us. He couldn't have cared less about international rules or international organizations. I think he would have been very much at home in the last administration. So for Nixon, Connally represented someone who could really get something done, and also someone who was not held down by preconceptions that may have stemmed from the time when the U.S. was so overwhelmingly strong and also very benevolent. And Nixon basically asked Connally to deal with the international economic system and make it so the U.S. had a better shot of succeeding than it looked like in 1971. But Nixon surrounded Connally with people who were real internationalists. And I think that's a very interesting part of this story. It's an interesting part of the story of 1971, but it has great echoes today that we have two kinds of thought. One, that we're getting a raw deal from the international system and it's got to change. And even at the cost of some destruction. And the other is that actually international cooperation is more necessary than ever. But in 1971, Connally represented the nationalist side. People like George Shultz and Arthur Burns, another person who you might have mentioned, Pete Peterson, and Paul Volcker. Nobody knew who these guys really were. But Nixon himself, he wanted to play hardball, but he did not want the overall international system to be weakened. He just wanted some adjustments for the U.S.
As you say, there were limits to this. He wanted to unwind this Bretton Woods compact, which was no longer workable for the U.S., but never contemplated sort of an America first attack on NATO.
Exactly. And, he brought in Henry Kissinger. After the decisions were made, he relied on Henry Kissinger to manage the foreign policy part of this. And, the economics and the foreign policy became one and the same. And the tension between Connally, the nationalist, and Kissinger, the internationalist, that tension was very clear. But one of the things that really interested me was that these two men really managed to work it out with one another, because they recognized that these were the two sides of Nixon himself.
Well, let's talk a little about Henry Kissinger. He was not at Camp David on that fateful weekend in August of 1971 because he was on his way to another secret meeting in Paris aimed at resolving the Vietnam War. A month earlier, as you say, he'd been in China laying the groundwork for the recognition of the People's Republic. For one thing, this reminds me as a former White House reporter that in any given time, in any given administration, there's a lot of stuff going on. Even as you shine a spotlight on this very pivotal meeting, there were lots of other things going on. But even though Kissinger wasn't there, he was the one who had to manage the international fallout. How did that go?
You know, it went pretty well, actually. It took about 4 months of negotiations that moved from London to Paris to Rome to the Azores back to Washington. Kissinger, most of the time, was in the wings, but he was in touch with all the key people, and mostly he was able to be a bridge between Nixon and Connally and bring together the economic and the foreign policy stuff where it really mattered, which was in the Oval Office. And I interviewed him at length. And he, you know, he remembers this activity as a great education to him because he never had anything to do with economics. And this weekend really showed that economic issues were absolutely crucial in the relations with Europe and Japan. And that until we could get this right, not only for the Allies, but for ourselves, the foreign relations were going to be on a very tenuous ground. And remember, this was the time when Nixon was about to go to China, and he wanted the Allies united. The worst thing for him would be to go to China and have some of the NATO countries carping in the background. And Nixon also wanted to begin arms control negotiations with the Soviet Union. And so he needed the Allies for that. So these economic issues, as Kissinger told me, it suddenly dawned on him that he better learn a little bit about it, because it wasn't just about troops. It wasn't just about military stuff. From the standpoint of Bonn, which was the capital of Germany at the time, or Tokyo, trade and investment and exchange rates were right at the heart of everything they cared about.
Obviously, the Soviet Union's position has changed radically in the last half century. China's has as well. What was happening to the U.S. standing on the global stage in 1971?
Well, 1971 was sort of a watershed period because everyone had taken for granted up until then, or I'll say up until the late 60s, that the U.S. had a very strong economy and that from that its strength really derived. But because of the Vietnam War and Johnson's failure to impose taxes to finance it, we started to experience inflation. And there was also, and you know, this obviously brings up a lot of parallels today, there was a big debate going on about macroeconomic policy and what role should the fiscal policy play and what role should monetary policy play. And we had something then which we don't have now, although I wouldn't rule it out, is that wages started to move up very fast. And no one was quite sure how you control that short of controls. So all these things started to mix together. The U.S. growth started to slow. Our trade deficit appeared for the first time, as you said, you know, since the 19th century. And I think the world began to look at the U.S. with a big question mark as to how strong were we? And how, to what degree would our domestic problems take our eyes off the international picture? And how good were our commitments if we were having all these problems at home? And all of that is really mirrored today. You know, I mean, it isn't that it's a straight line, but I think what you see, the reason I was so interested in this one meeting, it was a great focal point for all of the trends and the dilemmas and the agonies that we as a country face time and again. You know, international engagement versus retrenchment, focus on domestic problems versus focus on foreign policy problems. How do we control prices? How do we deal with, you know, with escalating wages? What is more important, unemployment or you know, price stability? All these issues are still around.
Lots of questions that we're asking today and particularly during this very summer, 50 years
right.
later.
And I think the thing about this summer was it was the first time in the post-World War II era that all these issues became really acute and they all came together. And that's what one of the reasons I was so engaged in researching and writing about it.
Yeah, the severing of the last shred of the gold standard there, in a way, I think you said it was the end of the Marshall Plan mentality.
It was an end of an era. And you know, I conclude the book by asking the question, are we not coming to an end of another era? You know, you never know at the moment, but you could make a case that then the era was really thrown off course, the old era, by economic problems at home. And certainly we have enough of those today. I mean, then there were not just economic problems, but there were big social problems. Unfortunately, they sound very similar. We had huge racial issues. We had huge problems in the cities. Remember, this was the end of the Vietnam era. We had huge political dissension. And, you know, we have all those things today. Then we really had a questioning about globalization was kind of a new force, but as soon as it appeared on the scene in the US, we were questioning, because the labor movement started to say, wait a minute, we're starting to lose jobs. And they were pointing at multinational corporations and saying, these guys are producing abroad. What's that game? Of course, you know, we talk about those same things now, in some cases, even in more acute form. Then the dollar started to come under a lot of pressure. I mean, money was flowing out into German marks and Japanese yen. Today, the dollar is very strong, but I think that you could make a case that we are at a kind of crossroads, and that if you looked at the next 10 years, the dollar will come under pressure from several sources. One of them is going to be our colossal debts. I won't belabor that, but you know, we are spending money, we are running deficits, we're accumulating debts at a rate that's really unprecedented, to say the least. But maybe more significantly, we are overusing financial sanctions because we have such unilateral power because we control the financial system. But I have to tell you that the Europeans and the Chinese are hell-bent to get out from underneath this. And the more sanctions we use, especially secondary sanctions, the more they are trying to figure out a way to create an alternative plumbing system for the global financial system. And then we've got the whole issue of cryptocurrencies and digital currencies. And I don't know so much about these, and I don't think anybody does, frankly. But my instinct tells me that we are where we were in 1990 with the internet. And that is, we know something big is going to happen. We just don't
know what shape it's going to take.
And what shape it's going to take. But to me, trust in the dollar is synonymous with trust in the U.S. And the trust in the U.S. from around the world is at the lowest level, I think, that it's been since World War II. And so people are going to want, it's not that they don't want to hold any dollars, but they're going to be looking for some alternatives, at first on the margin, alternatives which do not revolve around the Federal Reserve or around anything in Washington, but basically are run by certain algorithms or run by a different kind of technological backbone. In any event, I think it's worth thinking about. Are we at the end of an era? Nixon was. How did those guys handle it? And you know, how should we?
You're listening to World Affairs, produced in partnership with KQED. If you want to hear more of our stories from around the world, you can check out our podcast. Just search for World Affairs, that's one word, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This week, we're looking at the legacy of the Nixon shock. When Nixon abandoned the gold standard and changed the world economy, the decision marked the end of an era. And as Jeffrey Garten points out, the United States is at a similar crossroads now. Our nation is deeply divided and withdrawing from a long and costly war, just like we were in the 1970s. And the global financial system is evolving in unpredictable ways.
Now to a wild ride on Wall Street.
Video game retailer GameStop is set to continue their head-spinning ascent today. Shares are now up more than 60%.
Prices are rising as the U.S. economy recovers from the pandemic downturn.
Well, in September, some 7.5 million workers will be facing the loss of their
world. And it's all about crypto collectibles. Non-fungible tokens, or NFTs, are exploding in popularity.
So what can we learn from the Nixon shocks? NPR's Scott Horsley picks up the conversation from here.
As you say, it's often difficult to know when these historical bookends are coming when you're living through them. But you had this delicious detail in the book about the Camp David meeting. Nixon had these windbreakers made for the participants. And they had the White House photographer there, which is not the norm at Camp David the way it would be, say, in the Oval Office. It seems as if there was a sense of the moment that this meeting was demarcating.
I think there was. And, you know, no really important meeting doesn't have some antecedents. So if you looked at the environment in 19, when Nixon was elected in the election of 1968. He took office in 69. There was a sense, you know, the Vietnam War was a total disaster and we knew we had to get out. We knew we were nowhere near as strong as we had been 10, 15 years ago. We saw the rise of Germany and Japan. We saw the European, what was called then the European community, beginning to coalesce. We were losing jobs because of trade, because of globalization. These strange structures called multinational corporations were just, you know, beginning to flex their muscles. We knew something was up. We just didn't quite know what. And I think by the time they got to Camp David, it had been a year or two of discussions and there'd been lots of studies. I think they knew it was, I'm quite sure they knew it was a really momentous weekend, but they didn't come to that conclusion on the Thursday before the weekend. You know, it was building.
Well, and interestingly, in a curious way, this unilateral action by the United States, which ruptured the stability and predictability that had endured ever since Bretton Woods, it kind of set the table, you say, for a period of remarkable international cooperation, which is not necessarily what you'd expect.
Yeah, I think that was also a big surprise to me, that Nixon and his team wanted to make a big adjustment, but they were under no illusion that we were going to need more rather than less cooperation going forward. And very shortly after the meeting at Camp David, OPEC started to raise oil prices. And that really set off a whole era of sort of global problems in a way we never thought about. There were global food shortages. There were scares about the growth of global population. There was the rise of developing countries into sort of cartels. And so the result of the US action was to say, it's almost like a broken leg that's repaired and is stronger than it was before. We did something that was very hard to do. We made a big change within an existing system and we strengthened the system. And I'm prepared to say there was a lot of luck there. But the one thing I know is that the people around Nixon, with the exception of Connally, this was not a Trumpian kind of vision that the international system is no good. It has to be strengthened, but in order for the U.S. to play a leading role, as Nixon said, we couldn't play with one hand behind our back. And so we needed a cheaper dollar. We needed a new kind of monetary system that gave countries more flexibility by floating exchange rates. And we needed a whole new way of thinking about trade It wasn't tariffs that was such the big issue. It was non-tariffs. It was regulations. It was health and safety standards. All these things we're still fighting over. But the real barriers to international commerce are not generally at the border. They have to do with different kinds of policies internally. I mean, that's really the big thing that we have going with China now, is that two different economic systems. So I think that they anticipated a lot of what, they anticipated the problems, but also recognize the need for more global cooperation. And I'd say that there's also a very strong parallel. We have very deep problems at home, of course, but if you listen to the current administration, they are putting a huge priority on cooperation on pandemics, on cooperation in the cyber area, cooperation above all on climate issues. So as in 1971, we need both. You know, President Biden keeps saying the domestic strength is what will give us the international strength. And I think that's exactly what Nixon was saying too. And I don't know how many people would put Nixon and Biden in the same, you know, in the same room, but actually they have a lot in common.
Well, let me ask you about domestic economics and the fallout there. Obviously, a decade of high inflation followed this meeting. There were lots of other factors, as you mentioned, OPEC and the wage and price controls kept a lid on that just for temporarily, and then they came roaring back. Nixon was not preoccupied with that. You wrote, in the trade-off between suppressing inflation and creating jobs, Nixon chose jobs. And that was maybe a legacy of his election loss in 1960, which he felt was scarred by economic slowdown. Nixon said no one ever lost an election because of rising prices. I think the Republicans right now are hoping to test that theory as they try to use the current high inflation as a cudgel against President Biden. In hindsight, was Nixon wrong to underweight inflation in the way that he did?
I think that the problem Nixon had is one I don't think we have right now. That is that he didn't believe in an independent Fed. The head of the Fed at the time was Arthur Burns. And Burns was a very, very smart guy, a renowned economist, but he had this yearning to be a good friend of Nixon. And Nixon knew how to play on that. And so the Fed didn't play the role that it should have. If the institutions had been working correctly, I think that Burns would have dealt with inflation, even though Nixon said he didn't care about it. We can argue about the exact trade-off, but what happened in the Nixon era is that they let their guard down on inflation altogether. You know, it didn't, and Burns even espoused a theory. It's hard for me to think he believed it, but he had a lot of credibility at the time, that inflation was not about loose monetary policy or too expansive fiscal policy, and therefore it couldn't be tamed by tightening budgets and raising interest rates. It was all about wage negotiations, because in those days the unions were very strong, the industrial unions, and they kept bargaining for higher wages, and then the companies would raise prices, and then the unions would raise wages, and this became a wage price spiral. And Burns said, until you deal with that, the rest doesn't matter. And I'm not sure he was right, but it was a convenient way for him not to put a lid on the economy and cross Nixon, whose friendship he really wanted. So there's a lot of human drama in this, as well as the technical part of policy.
Always. Yeah, absolutely. And our current Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, has said they're not at all asleep at the switch when it comes to inflation. They're watching those signals very carefully. And she said that they're not seeing any of those signs of that kind of wage price spiral today. I do want to ask you about the Federal Reserve then and now has officially these twin goals, stable prices and maximum employment. The current Fed's new framework, though, which they adopted last summer, says that they're not going to go after inflation preemptively. Obviously, we've had decades now of relatively low inflation. We're not in the situation they were in 1971. And we've learned from the period just before the pandemic how really good things can be when you're close to full employment. That is good for people who are maybe on the margins, wages coming up for those at the bottom, and so forth. The Fed today is not watching election returns the way Nixon was. They're not motivated by politics there. But do you worry at all that the Fed's not as attuned to inflation as it should be?
I personally don't worry about that. And I feel that the disparities of wealth and income have been widening for a long time. And that it is time to give much more attention to those who haven't been really fortunate, which is like 80% of the country. This formula that you don't have to balance it every year, but it has to average out to about 2.5, which means you could run it higher for a while, given that it's been lower for a while. I think that constitutes a certain amount of social justice, and that we have some really good people in office now, that Yellen and the chairman of the Fed, they're not going to let inflation out of the bag. They may allow it to go a little higher, but I think they're acutely conscious that if it's allowed to go to the point where it's embedded in expectations, then they very well may not have the kind of control they want, or they may have to raise interest rates too precipitously. I think they're aware of all of this, and that the big question is their analysis right that it's that so many of these things are transient? You know, are they correct that once we get the economy on an even keel and can make up for some of the distortions of the pandemic, we will have much smoother sailing? I don't know enough about, you know, the structural stuff to know whether they're right, but I'm inclined to give them the benefit of the doubt, because I don't think they have any ulterior motives, and I can't imagine two people who are better equipped to make these judgments.
And the Fed chairman, Jerome Powell, told lawmakers just this week that they are keeping a close eye out for any change in expectations to see if people start to assume that prices are going to keep ratcheting up, which can become sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If that happens, he says, they would jump in and get a handle on inflation. But for now, they do think it's temporary, and they're going to let it run a little hotter for the time being. We were talking a moment ago about the dollar and the ongoing strength of the dollar and the trust in the dollar. And as you say, that's tied to the trust in the United States. Even though you said trust in the U.S. is maybe at a low point, there still seems to be an enormous demand for the dollar. It wasn't the gold in the U.S. that made the dollar attractive after all.
Yeah, I look at it this way. For most of history, currency was backed by some commodity. And when the dollar was cut loose from gold, there certainly were a lot of people who felt that the whole system is going to be in crisis mode. And that, you know, there was no way to judge what is value. And you have to admit one thing, that the dollar may have stayed preeminent, but, you know, before 1971, there were virtually no international banking crises. Afterwards, we had a lot more of a roller coaster financial system. And we've had a huge number of crises, you know, culminating in 2008, which really was the mother of all of them. So it wasn't that nothing changed, but the dollar stayed really strong, I think, for a couple of reasons. One is no currency was backed by you know, a commodity, and therefore it was all relative. And people had more confidence in the Fed, in the rule of law in the U.S., in the political stability, than they did anywhere else. And so it all became relative. You know, there really wasn't a big choice to be had. I think that this is changing, and I think it's probably changing much faster than we in the U.S. understand. I think that January 6th was an inflection point and has raised the most basic questions about our entire political system, our political stability, our democracy, and that is this is going to come out in how people look at the dollar. It doesn't happen overnight, but it certainly happens in the minds of the Chinese leadership, and I believe it's happened in the minds of the European leadership, and that there will be a searching and, let's say, a more welcoming attitude towards alternatives, which at first may seem marginal, but could very well grow, not to totally dethrone the dollar, but to make the dollar much less central than it is today. And I'm not saying this is not an election issue, you know, for the midterms or anything like that, but by the end of this decade, I think that's a better than even chance, unless we can really get a handle on our political system, that the dollar is going to be substantially weakened in terms of the global role that it plays.
Yeah, as you say, there are others, the government of China, for example, others in the private sector that would like to develop a rival.
Many in the private sector. And, you know, I mean, Facebook would like to develop a rival. You know, if you have companies like Facebook, or let's say if Walmart comes up with some kind of an electric system to deal with all of its internal accounts, I mean, we are seeing a major fracturing of the global political system now. And why is it so unthinkable that the financial system will be fractured too? Certainly the trading system is. And yet we've got the dollar holding everything together right now. It seems to me a precarious state and potentially a real anomaly.
You mentioned one of the other characters in your book, Pete Peterson, who was sort of the international economic Sherpa in the White House, and obviously went on to other things as well. But he drafted this report that wasn't just about currency, but really a broader look at industrial policy in the early 70s, a little bit like Peter Navarro in the last administration, but without the reflexive anti-China rhetoric. And he sized up the drift in 71 by saying no one in government was saying, here's where we are, here's where we want to get to, and here's how we get from here to there. Did the people who participated at that Camp David meeting get where they wanted to go in the end, do you think?
You know, I don't think they looked too far ahead. I think they diagnosed the problem as being the U.S. needed some major adjustments from the post-World War II days, and these adjustments had been put off and put off, and they finally had to bite the bullet. I think they felt we would be much better off, but they did not anticipate that we would go to floating exchange rates so fast. And they certainly didn't anticipate the disruption that oil price increases. Well, they didn't even anticipate we would have the oil price increases, let alone the disruptions. There are many things they didn't anticipate, and I give them credit for this. They were very resilient and they rolled with the changes. And it made me conclude that one of the things about operating in the global economy is you need a great deal of humility, because it's so complex and there's so many players. And to say we're going to go from A to B over a long period of time is a very difficult thing to do, and probably is not the most intelligent kind of calculation. We need resiliency, and we need to be prepared to deal with a lot of different situations. But one thing Peterson said, which the group did not take up, but he said in 1971, we can't be a strong country if we just focus on exchange rates or trade policy. He said the name of the game is in how we invest in ourselves. He said, imagine this, 1971, we are going to be facing enormous challenges in technology. We're entering a world of high technology. And although we have the lead now, we won't automatically maintain it. And where is our long-term plan to invest in technology? And he said, we are going to be losing a lot of jobs to automation. What are we doing about that? Where are we investing in our people? Where is the investments in training and apprentice schools? He says, we're not thinking about things because we're not thinking ahead. But he was really, he wasn't thinking about the whole world so much as how do we strengthen ourselves? And I think that's a major part of the discussion today too.
You mentioned the financial crises that have followed this decoupling of the dollar and gold and the unpredictability that followed. But in the end, did this unleash a more dynamic global economy? In the end, was it positive for the U.S. and for the rest of the world?
Yeah, I think that is really that's really a key issue. There are some negatives associated with what happened. I mean, in my view, once you de-link the dollar from gold, you created enormous risks that come with the volatility of currencies. And that created all kinds of new financial instruments leading to derivatives and derivatives on top of derivatives. And I would say to a global financial casino in which one of the key activities was money making money rather than money being invested in productive enterprises. I think that characterizes a huge amount of our economy today. It's one of our biggest problems. And I think it's a social problem as well, because it has a lot to do with the concentration of income and wealth. So that's the negative. The positive is exactly what you said, Scott, is that this gave us the flexibility to proceed in a globalized economy, increasingly globalized economy, and to ride out the waves. And this gave a certain amount of dynamism to our industries and to our trade. And, it's no accident that we've had some of the longest, deepest business expansions in our history just in the last couple of decades. So I would say that on balance, net, we were better off not linking the dollar to gold, but I don't want to say that it's all smooth sailing and that there aren't a lot of costs to bear as well.
Yeah. Well, and if President Biden decides to mark the 50th anniversary of this meeting by summoning his advisors to Camp David or maybe to his beach house in Rehoboth, and you were tasked with writing a Pete Peterson-style memo, a briefing book on the challenges ahead, what would you say about where we want to go, what risks we're facing, and what we might take as lessons from this secret meeting 50 years ago?
Well, that's a great question. I think the first thing I would say is we can't minimize all the problems we have at home and abroad, but we also have to look ahead, and we have to have really substantial peripheral vision. And so somewhere in the government, I would really like to see more work done, unless it is being done, I don't know, but I'm assuming there could be much more work being done on what is the world, what could it look like 10 years from now, and what does it mean for us? And obviously a lot of that would center on technology, but I think it just as much has to center on the social fabric and what we need to do to build that up. So that'd be one thing. The second is I'd take a lesson from what Nixon did, and I would make sure I surrounded myself with people with very diverse views. At Camp David, you had Volcker, who was very, very keen on fixed exchange rates. He wanted a cheaper dollar, but he wanted it fixed again. And you had George Shultz, who simply couldn't understand why exchange rates would be fixed, and thought everything was a question of price, and that it should be, it should all be floating. And Nixon sat, and you had a guy like Connally, who basically wanted to sock it to other countries. And then you had Kissinger, who was talking about how do we redistribute power and maintain leadership. So he was surrounded by great minds with very different views. And I would hope that Biden was very conscious of that. Does he have people who are telling him very different things from other people? It doesn't mean they're right or they're wrong, but is he hearing all of that? I think that would really be key. And then I would say that one of the biggest issues we face is how to deal with China. And I am very, very disappointed in the way the Chinese operate. I was in the Clinton administration and helped China get into the World Trade Organization, had very high hopes. But I don't think that this course of action of trying to decouple in the trading area is realistic at all. And I would really like, and yet I think that, you know, this train is moving in that direction very heavily, and I would really want to focus on something like that, because the real difference between, one of the big real differences between 71 and now is there was no China then. I mean, there was West Germany and Japan, but compared to the challenge that China poses, they were nothing, and the Soviet Union wasn't even a factor in the global economy. So I think the China dimension is really, really important too.
The table at Camp David might need some seats for international partners as well.
And that's a very good point. That we were at the height of unilateral power in 71. I think it was the beginning of the end of it, but we didn't know that. Or maybe we did know that, but we didn't. We used the last gasp of unilateralism to tell the world economy is going to change, and here's how it's going to happen. We can't do that now. We can't even come close to doing that now. So you're right. There's no one. You can't go to Camp David and redesign the world. It has to be a much more partnership approach with other countries. And I think Biden really understands that. And the key thing is, how do you operationalize it?
Once again, Jeffrey Garten's new book is 3 Days at Camp David, How a Secret Meeting in 1971 Transformed the Global Economy. It's a great read about a historical event, and it's just as relevant 50 years on. Jeffrey Garten, thanks so much for joining us.
Your pleasure. Thank you, Scott.
You've been listening to World Affairs, produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and from listeners like you. If you want to support the program by becoming a member or making a donation of any size, please go to worldaffairs.org/donate. And we want to hear from you. What did you think of this episode? Do you have any ideas for future programs? Please email us at feedback@worldaffairs.org. This episode was produced by Matteo Schimpf and Teresa Katsourilis. Elise Manoukian is our associate producer. We had production assistance from Ryan Housel. Tatum Senderbeck manages our website. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our executive producer is Joanne Jennings. And our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Philip Yun. Thank you for listening.